UK Wine Show, show number 101. Hugo Sharp on Australian wine and the Oz Wine Show. In this week's show,
we certainly don't get that many cheap international wines.
And in the news, Valpolicella producer chooses screw cap instead of Classico classification, sparkling wine sales grow faster than champagne, and Hardy's to spend £12 million to promote their brand.
G'day! Welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 101 for the 17th of April 2008. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's show we're talking with Hugo Sharp. Hugo is the man behind the Oz Wine Show, and we're going to be talking to him about his show, the Oz Wine Show, and the Australian wine scene. But next up, we say hello to Jane Scott and the wine news.
My first story this week is about the Italian producer Allegrini, who has chosen to use screw caps and forgo its Valpolicella Classico denomination. The Italian regulations for Valpolicella Classico don't allow for the use of screw caps, but Allegrini believes that they retain the freshness of its wine better than corks. And as the producer sees this as such a crucial component, it's decided it's worth abandoning it and becoming just Valpolicella. As you know, Classico, appended to the name of the wine, indicates that it's been produced in the historic zone, which gave the wine its name. And as such, this zone should offer the ideal climate and soil conditions for making the wine. We spoke to David Gleave of Liberty Wines, who distribute Allegrini in the UK, and they believe that Allegrini made the right decision, and it's Italy that's losing ground by not amending its regulations. The law regarding closures is even stricter in some regions. For example, in Suave Classico, even wines from the subzones must use cork. David thinks producers should be able to use screw cap if they want to, and it should not be a decision made by bureaucrats in Rome. What do you reckon, Chris?
Cheers, Jane. As you know, I'm a big fan of screw caps, but you need to be careful when switching over to screw caps. On Wednesday, I went and saw Simon Harrop, MW, at the International Wine Competition. He was going through the faulty wines from the competition, and I tried 100 faulty wines with him. Fantastic. Whilst the wines weren't great, it was a very good educational point. And the number of wines that had sulfur problems was quite high, almost as high as problems you had with cork taint. However, countries that have been using screw cap for a while, such as New Zealand, the problem was much, much less. And I think the issue is an educational one with winemakers rather than a problem with the closure. So a slow change to screw cap is probably a good idea for the Italians.
Excellent. Okay, well, next we have the news that sparkling wine sales are outperforming champagne in the UK as more and more drinkers turn to fizz as an everyday treat. According to the latest research from Mintel, volume sales of sparkling wines in the UK have soared 44% since 2002 to hit 42 million litres. Champagne sales, on the other hand, increased by only 24% to reach 29 million litres in 2007. According to Mintel, the reason for the shift to sparkling wine is due partly to a change in consumer attitudes. Previously, champagne was the only accepted choice, and sparkling wine was seen as a second-rate imitation. Now, though, sparkling wine growers have turned the market round by producing consistently good quality wines and giving consumers more choice. Sparkling wine is now seen as an enjoyable treat in its own right, and the fact that it costs only a few pounds more than a regular bottle of wine is just an added bonus. In value terms, sparkling wine sales rose 27% on 2002 figures to reach £385 million in 2007. And it's the new world wines such as Jacob's Creek, Hardy's Crest and Lindauer that have proved popular in the UK because of their strong branding and reputation for quality. They're also the wine of choice for many young professionals, especially after work. Any comments on that news story, Chris?
Well, I'm not surprised champagne's been underperforming in the UK market compared to the other fizz market as a whole, especially when you look at wines like Lindauer from New Zealand. It's a great drop, and it certainly shows what an inexpensive fizz can achieve. Another style of fizz I quite like is reserve quality carver. Not the normal carver, but reserve quality. It has complexity, and it's often nowhere near as acidic as other styles of fizz. And at the price, it's not surprising these wines are taking market share away from champagne, who, let's face it, While it's a great drop, there's been a slow and steady price rises without an increase in quality from champagne. So this has given other producers a great opportunity to steal market share from them. If you want to find out more about Cava, when I was in Barcelona a month or two ago for the climate change conference, I popped down and had a chat to a couple of Cava producers. These will be coming out in shows around August time. Any other news, Jane?
Well, my final story is that Hardee's are to spend £12 million on their marketing campaign this year. It's the most ever to be spent on a wine brand in the UK. Their aim is to maintain their number one brand position here in the UK, as well as getting new consumers to try wine. The campaign will focus on Hardee's heritage, and the theme is One Love Since 1853, and tells the story of Thomas Hardee, whose passion and determination founded the Australian brand over 150 years ago. The story goes that he had a dream to produce exceptional wines from the New World, and his enterprising and resourceful spirit brought that dream to life. The big push begins this month with TV advertising within films and dramas, along with sponsorship of Sky Box Office. They're also linking up with The Times for Movies That Matter and sponsoring Love Film, the UK's biggest DVD rental service. There'll also be other events, in-store activity and promotions running. Basically everything they can do to get us trying and drinking Hardee's wine. And as the president of Constellation Europe, Troy Christensen, puts it, they're giving consumers a compelling reason both to buy into wine and to buy Hardee's.
Cheers, Jane. I do think I need to make a bit of a confession with that news story. I have in the past, and I am scheduled to do some work in the future for Hardee's. I'll give you guys an update at some point in the future, but thought you should know that about now. Is that all the news this week, Jane?
Yep, but don't forget you can get more detail on any of these stories at our website 3050.co.uk. Just go to the news homepage and click on Wine News.
Cheers, Jane. I hope the news didn't sound as disjointed this week as it did last week, but I'm sure Jane and I will get the hang of this communicating between the two of us a bit better. Another thing to get the hang of is the new 500ml wine bottles, which is this month's poll question. If you recall, the question was, wine is mainly sold in 750ml bottles, but some producers are putting their wine into 500ml bottles to share between two. Do you think small bottles are a good idea? The results are starting to come in firm and fast, and at the moment the results seem to indicate that many of you don't see the need for smaller bottles, while some would buy them occasionally. The final results will be out at the end of the month, so do have your say before the end of the month. You can do that by going to ukwineshow.co.uk and clicking on Vote in Our Poll on the right-hand side. While there, you can also get a full transcript of this week's Spotlight. This week, we start a two-part series looking at organic wine. And next week, we talk about biodynamic wine, vegans, and sustainable viticulture. So this week's Spotlight on sulfur and organic wine. Organic wine is a lot more rare than you think. Next time you're in the supermarket or wine merchant and you see the sign organic wine, take a good look at the bottle. Is it organic wine or wine made from organic grapes? And what is organic wine? Organic wine is made by organic grapes using an organically approved winemaking process. Sounds fairly straightforward, but in that sentence is a world of confusion. In reality, there is very little organic wine. However, there's a lot of wine made from organic grapes. The biggest barrier to producing organic wine is, in fact, preservatives. Organic wine should not contain any preservatives. However, it's been almost impossible until now to make wine without preservatives. The big one is sulfites, which are occasionally labelled on the back as contain sulfates, or occasionally you might see it described as preservative 220. If the label does not mention this, it doesn't mean it's sulfur-free. It's just that the winery simply didn't need to label it. Not all countries require wines to label their additives. In Europe, there's no minimum requirements for labelling, while in the US, sulfite labelling is compulsory. And as a result, many wines from the New World for import into the UK and US markets will often be labelled contain sulfites, while many of the European winemakers simply don't bother labelling it at all. But why bother labelling wines correctly? The biggest complaint with sulfites added to wine is that they cause headaches. This is true particularly for cheap wines where sloppy winemaking techniques can be hidden by adding more sulfites to the wine. Sulfites are present in both red and white wines and can cause asthma-like symptoms. which is estimated to occur between 5 and 10% of patients with asthma. These symptoms are more likely to occur in patients with severe asthma or those with whom asthma is poorly controlled. Reactions can be mild through life-threatening. Occasionally, patients exposed to sulfites will experience symptoms similar to anaphylaxis with flushing, fast heartbeat, wheezing, hives, dizziness, stomach upsets, diarrhea, collapse, tingling, or difficulty swallowing. But the news is not all bad. While wines made without sulfites tend to be short-lived, new winemaking techniques and the uptake of screw cap, which by its nature requires less sulfites than corks, mean that new sulfite wines are arriving into the UK. Many from countries such as Chile, but don't expect wines to become completely free of sulfites. Even with no added sulfites, wine naturally has a very small level of sulfite occurs naturally. This is a byproduct of fermentation. But who sets the rules with organic wines? Organic wines are governed around the world by a range of authorities. Each country has their own organic body that sets the rules. In Europe, for example, the EU sets a high-level set of rules that any wine produced in or imported into the Europe must comply with. Each country within Europe has its own governing bodies, which add to European legislation. In the UK, the Soil Association has a set of rules which comply with EU legislation, while the Organic Food Federation oversees production, obeying EU rules, but not necessarily the Soil Association rules. In America, the National Organic Program sets out organic rules which are more onerous by nature than the EU rules. The result is that many producers tend to follow the tougher set of rules to target their desired export market. The makeup of each country's governing body varies. In some countries, they are independent, others are charities, while others are still government bodies. The key thing is that each organic body are in close consultation to keep the laws within the countries in harmony with each other as much as possible. The situation is very different for biodynamic, vegan, and vegetarian wines. Here, there is little legislation, and the quality of the product is a reflection of the organisation that allows their logo to be used in the packaging. For example, a biodynamic wine may be approved by Demeter, or possibly by Biodyn. Their logos and associated quality assurances is the most important factor. This ends this week's Spotlight on organic wines. You can get a full translation of the Spotlight by going to ukwineshow.co.uk and clicking on Organic Wine, where you can get the full text as well as interviews from some of the older shows that we've done with organic producers. I hope to, over time, add all the interviews to somewhere on our site that you can access. This includes chats with producers and generic shows. As a bit of a teaser, I've also been looking at the shows that we've got coming up over the next few months, and we've got some great stuff. I talk with San Harrop, MW, an expert on wine faults, about the different problems wine have. A great overview on Italy from renowned Italian journalist Ian Delgata. A deep look at Cava, as well as Richard Smart giving me a bit of a hard time on the myths of viticulture. But this week, we're talking with Hugo Sharp. Hugo launched the Oz Wine Show just before I started the UK Wine Show, and we talk with Hugo about his show and the big picture of that big country, Australia. Let's have a listen to that. Hi, I'm here with Hugo Sharp from the Oz Wine Show. How are you, Hugo?
I'm doing very well, Chris. Thanks.
Excellent. Quite nice. Oz Wine Show, UK Wine Show. Nice we tie in there.
Sounds almost planned.
Yeah, almost. I'm in Sydney now, so I thought we'd have an opportunity just to have a bit of a chat to you about your show and also some of the other things that you're up to and maybe a wee bit about the Australian wine scene from your perspective. Does that sound good?
Sounds good. Very good. Yeah.
Excellent. Let's talk a wee bit about the Oz Wine Show. You've done about 11, 12, 13 shows now?
Oh, 15 is ready to go out the door.
Yep.
So it's not many over, I think it's over 2.5 years now.
So, I know, because you were out before we started.
Yeah, it was a good start, but the endurance seems to have waned a bit more for, essentially it is a hobby, and just timing of producing the shows, and I sort of held them to a higher standard than I probably should have given the time I could commit. But yeah, they've been really fun, but and I've always been wanting to get up to that one a week stage, but yeah, just getting them out the door is always a tough thing.
Yeah, it takes a bit of effort, I must admit. What was the reason you started the show?
I started the show, I was listening around about February of 2005, I was started listening to podcasts, and wine podcasts were one of the subject matters that I found myself listening to quite a lot. Grape Radio mainly, Winecast, Wine for Newbies a bit, but they're all American focused, and though the content was good, applying them to my own wine experiences was a tougher task, given they're all Californian wines or French wines, and Australia doesn't see many, a few French wines and definitely not many Californian wines at all. So no one else was doing an Australian wine podcast, so I thought I'd do one, and I knew the technical side and roped in a friend who knew the wine side a lot more than me. Who had a big history in the wine business. So I thought it was a pretty good team, and that's how we started.
Excellent. A lot of the shows recently, it's just been you doing the interviews. Who's the other fellow?
The other guy is Mick Barrett, who's done a number of wine vintages since he was a teenager. His dad's down at SA Uni looking at viticulture, and teaming up got hard to team up with certain shows. So I found that it was easier for me to just get along to wine shows and accost winemakers and steal 10 minutes of their time. So I found I had a lot of recording of tastings and that sort of thing. So I've just been, that's the level of activity I've been able to achieve, is just getting those out.
Who's been your most popular person to interview?
Most popular person interviewed on the show, because it wasn't me doing the interviewing, was Ernst Lawson from Dr. Lawson Wines of Germany.
Yep.
That's been far and away the most popular show in terms of downloads. And that was done by Dave Brooks, who runs an Australian wine blog called Vinosense, vinosense.com. And he said he was doing that interview, and I said, oh, can I record it? So I went along and recorded it. And Ernst is a really great character of the international wine world, so it's a really good interview, that one.
We did an interview with Wines Germany, they're the generic body in the UK, and I got a lot of feedback from people saying they really liked the show, they would have preferred some more high-end German producers. Do you get a lot of German wines over here?
No, not many at all. Yeah, it's a funny game in Australia, it's probably much the same as the UK, but we don't sell in supermarkets, though supermarkets nowadays do generally have a liquor store just on the side of it, which is a separate counter and that sort of thing. But and they house a lot of generic wines. Then you've got retailers that probably don't have as many outlets as the supermarket outlets, but they are more specific. They have higher-end stuff. And then you've got your very high-end retailers, but there's not many of those. And one owner will probably only own one or two stores. So.
Yep.
That's your spectrum. And to find good international wines, you're going to have to go to those high-end boutique places.
Yeah.
And to be near one of those is a barrier. And then to have a rapport with the staff and the owner is not a challenge, but just something that needs a bit of time if you're going to be spending money on international wines. Because we certainly don't get that many cheap international wines. So if you do want to go international, you're going to have to spend $50 or more.
I had a look around. I haven't looked in the supermarkets yet, but I've had a look at, is it Vintage Cellars?
Yep.
They're a chain of stores. They're not too bad. And a couple of local ones, Ultimo in Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
They had some interesting wines, particularly Ultimo. There was like loads of French, you know, high-end French stuff, all sorts of things, but maybe not the international range that you'd get in maybe even a supermarket in the UK.
Mm. Yeah, Vintage Cellars is good. They are. They have a number of stores and they have a good range, both cheap and expensive wines. But yeah, it's still limited to, you know, what they're buying that month or that season.
Yeah. In the UK, we have loads of wine shows. You know, every week you can't move for opportunities to sample or quaff. There's always something going on. What about in Australia? You know, you've got your big shows, haven't you?
Yeah, there's definitely big shows. Yeah, they'll run for 4 or 5 days, 2 days of judging, and then 1 or 2 days open to the public, normally on the weekend. And they're really good, but I don't think you sort of have to be in the know of them to get along to them. They're certainly open to the public, but I don't know that the public are aware that they're really even invited to a lot of them.
Do you have to pay to go to them or pay at the door?
Generally, yeah. So there's the one aimed most at the public would be the Good Food and Wine Show in Sydney, mm-hmm. which obviously has food and wine. Half of it would be wine, and then that's $20, $25 to get in. And then you can obviously taste wines from the producers.
Is it free sampling or is it?
Yeah, it's free sampling, yeah, but yeah. You can only get their details, you can't buy at the event.
Yeah, yep.
And they're good. It is a bit of a hustle and bustle, and so to get the ear of the person behind the stall and actually find out more in depth details about that winery can be a bit tough.
What about the competitions here? There's quite a few competitions. Do you follow the competitions closely?
Yeah, there's a number of wine shows. And they range from big city shows, Sydney Royal Wine Show, Adelaide Wine Show, right down to regional wine shows, and even you get the occasional touring biodynamic show or things like that, themed events. Yeah, there is a bit of a show scene, and it is used a lot for wineries to tout how well they've done with putting the little stickers on their wines and that sort of thing.
So would you say the Sydney big one?
Sydney Royal Wine Show, that's a pretty big one.
And the other one was the Melbourne?
Each
state.
Major, yeah, capital city generally has their own show, and each region will have their own.
So, I've seen, awards for shows and that I've never really heard of from Australia, so I'm just trying to work out what, if I see an award for, say, the Sydney Royal Show, that, if there's a gold standard there or something like that, then that's a pretty good event. Whereas if you see the Orange Regional Wine Tasting Show for primary schools, is that? I'm just trying to work out which of the shows that when we see these stickers on the bottles in the UK.
So you get all the stickers, do you?
Sometimes, yeah, sometimes.
It's the best guide would be to go for the bigger the city, the bigger the award, I guess. Yep. But, yeah, the stickers can get a bit dubious when you get down to the bronze stickers and that sort of thing.
At a regional show.
Yeah. But, they're a decent guide. But if that's all you've got to go on, then, yeah, it's probably more an issue with the retail stores in that you're more limited to what they stock as opposed to, the best wines being available for you to buy.
What do you think are the most up-and-coming areas in Australia or the areas that are sort of, the most interesting areas at the moment? You're obviously based in Sydney, so you've got Hunter Valley and Orange around you, Mudgee. But, I did a show from the Granite Belt up near Brisbane a wee while ago, and a lot of people really liked that because Brisbane people don't even know they've got a pretty decent wine region just beside on their back door.
Yeah, yeah. Up-and-comings, I haven't had much from the Granite Belt, and I do find myself in the Hunter Valley a lot more than any other region. My girlfriend said I can't have any more trips to wine regions until we've gone to somewhere without wine.
Oh, no. So, Marlborough.
I've tried New Zealand, yeah, but she caught me on that one. Up-and-coming regions. There's certainly regions getting more awareness. Mornington Peninsula,
yep, I guess. Down Melbourne.
And to define awareness, people in Melbourne will know about it, but a lot of other Australian or international people won't know about it. But, they're doing some really good Pinots and that sort of thing. Margaret River, which is in WA, which is just south of Perth, that's always been a well-regarded region amongst the industry. But I'm hearing it sort of mentioned to me from, a lot more from general public is I had this really good Margaret River wine.
Is that because they weren't really affected by the drought and they're the only people who really can supply bulk grapes now?
I'm not too sure, actually. I think the bulk grapes do come from the plains of New South Wales, Victoria and South Australia.
There's Riverland and Riverina.
Yeah, and the Adelaide plains and that those sorts of places. So they've got irrigation, they're still churning out the wines and they'll often be noted as southeastern Australian or just South Australian in terms of the categorisation. Categorised area. I don't know how affected they have been by the drought, but I think they've just been plugging along and just doing what they, what they know and what they do best and just refining their wines and Yeah, they're producing some really good stuff at the moment.
I was up at Orange yesterday, and they look like the drought's broken now. Or well, for them anyway, they were like pretty convinced that it was fairly wet, and it was a wet day I was there, so everything's pretty green. Do you is the drought broken? Because you're now moving into a El Nino effect, where generally it's a lot wetter.
There's La Nina and El Nino. I'm not sure which we're moving into, but I know there has been some rains. It's really dependent on the area. As to if the drought's broken or not. You say Orange is green, so I can only say that the drought's broken there for the time, which is good. But I'm sure there's other areas that are still doing it tough.
Yeah.
But in terms of, I guess it's that old quality and quantity gradient as to whether we'll see the wines, more wines at a lower quality or...
Do you think the drought's improved the quality of the Aussie wines?
I think it's well regarded that has been the case, though last season there were some pretty nasty frosts that did a lot of damage, probably from a fair way south of Orange down through to north of Adelaide. I think they got some nasty frosts. But, there's definitely been a long string of well-regarded vintages for the last 3-4 years.
And that's due to the drought?
Yeah, I think so. And so we have, from all reports, I think we have moved out of the glut.
Yep.
And it didn't take long.
No.
With the droughts for us to move out of that glut. So, yeah, there's less wine being produced, but I think it is generally of a high quality.
What about when we were covering the news, we saw Lindeman's, because of the drought, were actually buying wines from Chile and Argentina to put in their branding in the UK because they just couldn't get the grapes at a decent price. Did you see a lot of movement in grape prices?
I don't track grape prices much, but I do know that when we were in the glut times, that a lot of contracts were cancelled from the bigger winemakers to their outsourced grape growers because they had too much wine, and so they just didn't source from as many grape growers. So I do know that contracts were cut there, and prices, I imagine, were pretty low at that point, but as I said, it's swung around pretty quickly, so I don't quite know where the grape prices would be at this point.
Yeah, yeah, okay. What about things like GIs, the geographical indicators?
Yep.
I've seen some big bun fights with King Valley and a few other things going on. Do you want to comment on GI issues from an Australian perspective?
Yeah, well, I've just been looking at GIs a bit with the new site that I'm putting together because I'm having to put those GIs into the database for each wine to be tallied against a region. And yeah, there's some, I don't know about inconsistencies, but there are some interesting facts that come out when you look at the GIs. They're run by the AWBC and it's a panel that assesses them. And I mean, it's a very tough thing to try and regulate because you start off with zones and then within each zone you've got a region and then you might have sub-regions in that zone and it's all sort of dependent on climate and, you know, even microclimates when you're getting down to the sub-region scale. And, yeah, you do find that, you know, there might be a huge area that is just one region and I don't know whether it's just because there's not a huge number of wineries in that region that it hasn't been splintered into more sub-regions. I think it is dependent on the wineries within each region requesting, you know, to be either a region or a sub-region. I think you need 5 producers in one area to be eligible to ask to be called a region. And there's no real area delineation. I think it's more climate and soil and that sort of thing.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I think one of the biggest anomalies is Tasmania. And I'm not too sure of the reasons, but there is no, there are no sub-regions in Tasmania. It's just the Tasmanian region, which I think will definitely change soon.
The climate changes from the west coast down to Hobart. You know,
yeah.
It's quite wet on the west, isn't it?
And especially the grapes that are being grown. I mean, it's a cool climate area, so you've got a lot of Pinot and Chardonnays and that sort of thing, both for table wines and for sparkling varieties. So I think when you're growing a grape for a different end product, be it sparkling or non-sparkling, I think there might be a case to apply to have different regions, you know, depending on which what the end result is.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah. Like, but like in Spain, you have Cava. It covers a large region in its own right up northeast of Spain. That it also overlaps other regions as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's definitely, it's big enough to almost definitely have a lot of microclimates in it. So, and yeah, with the different grape productions, yeah, there would certainly be overlapping uses for the land.
So what else is new for you, Hugo?
At the moment, I've been spending the last year almost planning and developing a new social wine site, mainly for looking at Australian and New Zealand wine regions and wines. It's open for anyone in the world to use, but I think the main benefit is for people mainly drinking Australian and New Zealand wines. Australia's at least is certainly doing some very good stuff with on the boutique front, and I'm very proud of boutique Australian winemakers at this point. They're sticking with what they do best and focusing on their regions and just crafting some really good wines and at decent prices relatively. And that's where I'm passionate about Australian wine, and it's on that small scale front where you get a lot of regional aspects coming out in the wines and you know, winemaker influences and that sort of thing. And that, I guess, is a driver of this site, is that I wanted to promote boutique wines and regions and get people, first of all, knowing the difference between each one and then being able to use that difference to pinpoint the wines that they really like. With 2,000 to 2,500 wineries in Australia, plus New Zealand wineries, you're going to have, you know, tens and tens of thousands of wines, and to get through that needs, I think, the help of a little bit of technology. So Project Vino is essentially about enhancing wine experiences, your wine experiences, and that's right down at the small scale of tasting wines, rating wines, and then getting recommendations of new wines to try, and then up at the bigger scale of just when you're out in the regions, enhancing what you do in the regions by giving you, you know, printable tools that you can take and suggest places to go if you haven't been to any of the region before, and tracking your thoughts and then feeding that back into the site and getting new recommendations. And it's a site that I hope will promote individuality amongst Australian and New Zealand wine makers.
What's the site called?
It's Project Vino, and it's at projectvino.com.au,
or
it's everything at the moment. So it's the main site's at .com.au, but
you can get to it anywhere.
Yeah, yeah. So that's been my focus, and that's taken away from Oz Wine Show for the last year. But yeah, it's up and running, and it's free to sign up and use. So
you talked about good economic, good priced wines with regional characteristics. Mm-hmm. What price point would you recommend if you're visiting Australia? You know, what sort of price point should you be looking for wines?
Yeah, that's a good point, because there's definitely a difference between Australia and UK prices in pure numbers. But I'd say $18 as a minimum. You know, if you don't want to muck about, you can certainly. I mean, it'd be reasonably hard to go wrong over $20.
That's $20 is like £9.
Yeah, I'm probably biased because I spend a little bit more than the average price on wine, but that average, I don't know, if you go into the stores, you'll see most things are $15.
Yeah.
There's obviously things at 10, but you wouldn't find much below 10. Yeah. So the price ranges are definitely higher in Australia than the UK, but $18-$20 Australian, and you're pretty much set.
Drinking well.
Yeah.
Okay, Hugh, I think we'll wrap it up there.
All right, thanks for that, Chris.
Cheers, mate. Cheers. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Hugo. He's a nice bloke, and I hope it all goes well for him. Next week, we stay in Australia, and we head over to an important region in Australia, but not really known outside it. I'm talking about Orange in New South Wales. We talk with Philip Shaw, winemaker and consultant, about Orange and why he set up shop there. So until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Jane Scott, recorded and edited by Chris Scott, and the news is researched by Sandra Clement. To listen to other shows, visit www.ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.